Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Tuesday, February 17th, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman. Aaron, today at our trapezoid table, we're going to have a round table discussion with Terry Tracy and Solomon Jones, two of our favorite guests, about all things happening in politics and public affairs.
Yeah.
National, state, and local. We're just going to whip through a whole bunch of topics. We'd love to hear from you this hour. What news are you paying most attention to? You can give us a call, 888-477-9499. We can email studio2@whyy.org, and we can leave a comment on YouTube or Facebook by dropping a comment in the chat. We'll talk about the partial shutdown. We'll talk about the SAVE Act, Epstein fallout, Trump's approval ratings, and a whole lot more.
Yeah, a lot of local stories, too. ICE pushback, governor's race. There's a lot going on.
There always is.
There's always a lot going on. So 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. We'd love to hear from you. And we have our trio of local news stories. A federal judge on Monday ordered the Trump administration to restore the slavery exhibit at the president's house at 6th and Market Street near Independence Hall. This was a big win for community groups who have been fighting this. The judge in the case, the Honorable Cynthia Roof, who was appointed by President George W. Bush, compared the federal government's argument that it can unilaterally control exhibits in national parks to the Ministry of Truth in George Orwell's dystopian novel 1984. And her order comes in response to a lawsuit that was filed by the Parker administration back in January, but it does not provide a deadline for restoration of that exhibit. It does, however, require that the National Park Service restore the exhibit to the way it was prior to its dismantling and take steps to maintain the site and ensure the safety of that exhibit. Attorney Michael Cord, one of the founders of Avenging the Ancestors Coalition, they joined the lawsuit brought by the city. He was on hand at the president's house yesterday. Supporters had gathered there for a rally, and they received the news that they had won. Cord, after the rally, expressed cautious optimism. Take a listen to what he had to say.
It's a great victory, but we are not going to get too excited because procedurally the government has a chance to appeal and ask for a stay of the judgment while they're appealing. But what we could possibly have gotten, we got it all.
So right now we'll see if, you know, the Trump administration appeals this decision. But, you know, the judge has ordered that they must restore that exhibit.
And if you haven't been following this, the President's House controversy, by the way, there's a it's a larger exhibit, but part of it tells the story of the enslaved people who lived there when George Washington was president. George Washington and John Adams lived there before, of course, the nation's capital was moved to Washington, D.C. Had a chance to, you know, skim through the judge's order decision. It was interesting. For a lot of reasons, you mentioned the George Orwell quote. Obviously, she was trying to make a point there. Mm-hmm. But it also talks about the history of Independence Mall. It's sort of an unusual national historic site. We think of national parks as preserving natural lands. But mm-hmm. this was a case where it was sort of the opposite, right? Independence Mall was a neighborhood.
Yeah.
And they demolished it. Mm-hmm. And the city was always part of that. And there was always a partnership with the city in terms of creating the mall and then building it out into what it's become today. And so her decision looked a lot at the history of that and how Philadelphia is, if not an equal partner, at least a partner in the preservation of this particular space. I don't know how applicable it's going to be to changes at other national park sites, because this is an unusual site in that, like I said, the city was always involved in its maintenance and preservation.
And they had an agreement that, you know, nothing would be changed unless there was a meeting and a discussion between the city and the federal government. And that didn't happen in this case.
So, by the way, I didn't know this. The city actually put up a lot of the money to create the president's
house. They did.
So there's also a financial sort of skin in the game here. So it was interesting. I learned some stuff reading through just what the judge wrote. So, story number two.
Yes.
Does it feel like it's hard to find a house these days? Well, it's not just you. According to industry data published by Axios Philadelphia, the average person listing a property in Philadelphia has lived in that property for almost 10 years, almost a decade. Back in 2005, that same number was under 4 years. What does it mean? People are staying put. This is a national trend, but Philly's housing market is a little sludgier than the national average. Why aren't homes turning over like they used to? Lots of potential reasons. High cost of buying a new home, higher mortgage rates, etc. Housing costs have become a huge political issue here in Pennsylvania. Governor Josh Shapiro just released a plan to try to address it. So this is some confirmation in the data of what a lot of folks are experiencing, which is that new houses aren't really coming on the market like they used to.
No. And you know, you mentioned Josh Shapiro, the governor, trying to, you know, clear some of the red tape so people can do that. And this has been a national conversation, local conversation. Philadelphia, you know, the mayor has her home initiative. But, you know, they talk about this as the golden handcuffs phenomenon, you know, people refusing to give up those low mortgage rates for higher ones. But it's starting to shift. I mean, Axios reported that for the first time since 2020, the share of U.S. homeowners with mortgage rates of 6% or higher exceeds those with rates below 3%.
Right, because everyone got locked in those low rates.
Yeah.
But now it's finally phasing out because people still have to move at some point.
At some point, you got to let it go. Yeah. But you know, people just don't want to do it. It's like, do you want to? You had this 3%. You had this. You bought your house for like $200K, right? Mm-hmm. Now the house you got to buy costs twice that. And you're going to have to pay 6% interest. People were like, no, I don't want to do it. And so they're white knuckling their mortgages, trying not to let go. But at some point, you got to go.
Right.
And everybody waiting on the sidelines, they want in. You know, it's been tough. It's been really tough for folks looking for a house.
And the obvious solution is to increase the supply of available houses just to make housing cheaper. But that's difficult to do. Shapiro's trying to do it from the state level. State doesn't have a ton of control over that type of thing. But certainly there's lots of folks that are interested theoretically in trying to boost the supply of housing here and across the country. But it, you know, it takes a while to get that done.
And remember when we did that show about NIMBY, people wanting more housing, but then it's tough because community groups will fight against it. So it's just so much red tape. So we'll see what happens, but a lot of talk about housing and affordability in America. Third story, interesting, curious Philly column by The Inquirer looked at why Philadelphia has so many chicken bones lying around on sidewalks and streets throughout the city.
So many what?
Chicken bones, man. Chicken bones, like people eating wings and discarding the chicken bones on the ground. Yes.
I'll let you continue.
Yes,
go ahead.
Yes, yes.
I have questions.
And now that the snow is melting, these chicken bones are visible literally everywhere. So Nate Vile did some research and discovered that there are two culprits. First, animals who forage through trash, raccoons, possums, rats. They tear through trash bags.
Wow, called them out by name.
Yeah, they dumpster dive. They look to get the last scraps of meat from chicken bones, and they leave the remnants all over the streets, especially near restaurants. You might see them, you know, disproportionately like gathered there. The second culprit, humans, people eating the wings on the go.
We're animals too.
Yeah, and discarding those leftover bones on the streets of Philadelphia. And the Inky actually includes photos from a woman who has been documenting the chicken bone phenomenon. And she found discarded bones in all sorts of places. And she's been sent photos from people just throwing bones all kinds of places. And by the way, when I moved to Philly, I noticed this. Chicken bones everywhere. By the bus stop, on the SEPTA bus. I mean, I just wondered about Philly. I had never seen so many chicken bones just everywhere.
Okay.
Yeah, I wondered about this.
I have not noticed this. I guess I'm just
not
paying
attention.
Now you're going
to start seeing them. Now you're going to start
seeing
them.
I guess so. Yeah, no, we have a lot of trash of all stripes, bones, wrappers, I guess. You know, it goes back to trash management. Because we put our trash bags out on the street. Mm-hmm. We don't put them in bins. And so an animal can, you know, tear through the plastic.
And there's the bones.
Yeah, and then they can get to the bones. So it does speak to a larger problem, which is we don't have great trash management here in Philadelphia. We don't have a system for dealing with waste that other cities have. I had to be honest, I hadn't noticed the chicken bone problem.
Yeah.
That hadn't come up
on
my radar.
And we love our wings here. I got to say, do we really love our wings disproportionately?
I don't think so.
I was like, I saw some chicken bones on somebody's car hood, by the way. Like somebody was eating near a bus stop and just left the bones on somebody's car. Like,
that seems rude. Maybe they had a personal beef.
And I got to mention that chicken bones, it's dangerous for dogs because if they eat them, it could get lodged in their digestive system and it could be life threatening. So, y'all, please throw the chicken bones in the trash can and in an actual bin and not just the the trash, because it is a trash management.
This has been
issue.
A Studio 2 PSA.
Yeah.
Throw your chicken bones in the trash can.
I had a problem with this chicken bone issue. Like,
I have no idea. I mean, look, they did a whole story about it, so clearly you're not alone.
Yeah, a lot of people have been asking.
This.
Curious Philly.
A lot of people have been asking. Okay.
Who are these people?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Who is the lot?
Yeah. You put that in the passive voice. A lot of people have been asking. Okay.
Me.
Sure. Sure.
So,
we're asking you today, what news have you been paying attention to? We're going to do a roundtable, go through a whole bunch of topics on the other side of this break. Studio 2 at WHYY.org, 888-477-9499. Put your bones in the trash can.
Please.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. It is our rapid fire news roundup where we discuss the biggest stories of the week, national and local headlines, from the battle over DHS funding to the Epstein file fallout and midterm election security.
Plus, we'll look at local pushback over ICE cooperation and proposed detention centers. And we'll check in on two of Pennsylvania's hottest races, the 3rd Congressional District and the governor's race. We got a lot of ground to cover this hour, and here to help us with all of that are two great columnists from opposite sides of the aisle. Terry Tracy is the founder of Broad and Liberty and CEO of Fideri News Network. Terry, welcome back to Studio 2.
Great to be here.
Solomon Jones is a Philadelphia Inquirer columnist and WURD radio host. Solomon, great to have you.
Great to be here.
Yes, and listeners, we want to hear from you. What news are you paying most attention to? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, you could drop a comment in the chat.
And we're going to start with the partial government shutdown that began on Saturday. This impacts funding to DHS. I mean, Terry, how do we get here? And are we going to get out of it anytime soon?
We'll get out of it. We shut down the government all the time at this point, so I'm not sure that it really matters. It's like every other month or every other year. Look, I would say that in some respects, people should take comfort in the place that we're in because it demonstrates that the system is working. You have a minority party in the Senate that felt very strongly about certain issues and pushed those issues to a point where we didn't shut down the entire government, right? Mm-hmm. We didn't hurt the people that otherwise need the resources from the government the most. And on the issues that were most contentious, we sort of punted for a couple of weeks, kept talking, and there are some lines in the sand that are ultimately going to get worked out. I don't think it's going to be a protracted, extended thing like it was last time. I think the politics of the moment are a little bit different, so the incentives are different. But, you know, for all of the sort of kicking and screaming about fascism and all that, this shows that the government, when it wants to, can still function the way it ought to. And that checks and balances still count, and it's forcing the administration's hand to negotiate, and there will be some kind of negotiated outcome.
Yeah.
Solomon, do you have the same sunny outlook on
our government?
Of course
I don't. No.
Government shutdown here?
No. I think that the government shutdown, the partial government shutdown, is necessary. I mean, the reality is that people have lost their lives to ICE. We know about two, Alex Preddy and Renee Good, but the reality is that there were more people than that. Those people just look different, speak a different language from a different place. But the fact that people are losing their lives meant that Democrats had to draw a line in the sand and had to shut down funding for DHS that will probably be temporary. But the reality is they have to take the masks off. We have to know who they are. How are you enforcing the law with a mask on? How are you enforcing the law when we don't know your name? We don't know who you are. You don't have a badge number. There's no way to identify you. That's not enforcing the law. In my view, that is almost, making the law a joke.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have any law enforcement where you don't know who they are if they're not undercover. You got a whole agency undercover? That's ridiculous, and they're taking people's lives.
And the Democrats, by the way, Terry, they're demanding body cameras, visible identification, judicial warrants for certain arrests, and of course they want the masks off. Republicans have said those requirements would endanger officers and interfere with enforcement, your thoughts on this, because we don't allow our police officers to walk around with masks on. They have badge numbers. If you have a problem with a nice officer, how do you get accountability? Your thoughts on the position that the Democrats are saying this is actually a very reasonable request.
Well, I think we have to go back to where this problem started, which is we allowed 10, 15, 20, God knows how many people to come across the border. And unfortunately, unfettered, unchecked, and people have been dying all along the way, whether that was making their way to the border, whether that was crossing the border, whether that was coming into unsafe situations in the country illegally. It has been a tragedy from the start. And it's a tragedy that we chose, right? Because the Trump administration, to its credit, has been able to get those border crossings, illegal border crossings, down to effectively zero, which means we allowed this to happen. We decided this should happen. And there's no question that there's collateral damage. And who is to blame and what have you? You know, we don't have enough time on the show today to get into all of that, given the agenda here. But the reality is that, you know, I think that Tom Homan has been the adult in the room. He's been able to take the temperature down in Minneapolis a bit. He made some comments over the weekend that I thought were reasonable. He pointed out the fact that, you know, you realize that the director of ICE, his wife was followed to work and filmed. His children have been doxxed. Their address is online. So, you know, these folks just categorizing them all, as Chuck Schumer did over the weekend, as thugs or as Krasner does as Nazis, is really unhealthy and only incites and creates more danger in an already very tenuous and very dangerous situation. So asking these folks to just take the Homan said, I'd like for them to take the masks off. I would. But how do we get to a place where these folks are not, their own lives, their own families are not in danger as well? And it starts with taking the temperature down. And I'll make one last comment and then I'll let Solomon jump in. But I find it very interesting that the dynamics are only this heated and the outcomes are only this bad in the places where authorities choose not to work with the federal government. The reality is, right now, as we speak, law enforcement agencies are cooperating all over the country to stop criminals, terrorists, drug traffickers, etc., without much fanfare. But this mess always happens when people want to yell and scream and tear the system down and not work together.
Yeah, Solomon, you can respond to that.
The only criminals and terrorists I see are ICE. I don't see immigrants killing people. I don't see them running around with masks on. What I see them doing is going to work, trying to take care of their families, trying to take care of their children. Certainly, there are criminals in every community, whether it's the majority community, whether it's the minority community, immigrants, people who were born here. Doesn't matter. There are criminals in every community. We have somebody with 34 felony convictions sitting in the White House running the country. The reality is this. No other agency is talking about, oh, we're going to get doxxed if we don't have masks on. The Philadelphia police aren't wearing masks. The state police aren't wearing masks. The FBI is not wearing masks. The ATF's not wearing masks. Why is ICE the only agency that's suddenly in all of this danger because they're supposed to be enforcing the law? I think that's BS. I do.
What would be your, well, you said line in the sand over funding. Mm-hmm. What would be your line in the sand, Solomon, over funding? Like, when would you consider relinquishing these funds to DHS? What conditions would you like to see met?
I think at the very least, they have to take the masks off. That's number one. And I think the other thing is they have to have some identification, and then they have to have body cameras. I think those three things create the kind of accountability that most police departments, law enforcement agencies across the country have. To turn around and blame the victims of this and say it's because of the immigrants. No, it's because this administration has chosen to have a lawless agency that is pretending to enforce the law.
Yeah. And we'll let you wrap this up.
I mean, the lawlessness was allowing 20 million people to come to the country.
They're killing people.
Who should we deport? Of the 20 million folks, who should be deported? A and B, here's another. I think you make a legitimate point about the Philadelphia police and the state police. All the more reason why they should be working with the federal government to do law enforcement in the traditional way to get folks who are otherwise presenting danger to the community.
Well,
out.
Maybe but both you can answer that. Like, who should be removed from the country?
I don't
and
think
what
that's
length
the question.
State people should go to do it? Because you asked that to Solomon. So, what would be your answer first, Terry? I mean, is it everybody?
I have now, like most political cliches, have come to hate the whole 80-20 term. Like, I don't like it. But the reality is that there is a broad coalition of the electorate that supports removing folks from this country who came here illegally and who have either in their past or currently behaved in criminal behavior.
Yeah, there's but a lot of the people, but a lot of the people being taken out now have not, but do the, not necessarily.
Listen, you're asking what my like what yeah. the once you get, once the operation starts and you find folks who are otherwise here illegally and ought to be deported. Should they not be deported?
Yeah.
But Solomon, your response there, like what it should, what is a, do you think is a rational and sane approach to deportation, essentially, is what we're talking
about
here.
Dealing with the
issue. I think that's blame shifting. I think the reality is this, that you have a president who came in saying, I'm going to deport more people than any president ever. Obama deported more people, but he did it under the law. He did it legally. He did it with people that didn't have on masks, didn't have their names obscured, weren't hiding their identities, weren't claiming that they're the victims. He did it in a way that followed the law. That is the way that it has to be done. No matter who we're deporting, you have to do it in a way that follows the law and protects the sanctity of life. There's no way in the world that American citizens should be dying at the hands of law enforcement.
And Terry, I just
want
to ask
you, Barack Obama killed American citizens with drones overseas. Yeah. So, I mean...
Again, blame shifting.
Yeah,
so, changing the subject.
No, fact.
Changing the subject.
And let's just put a pen in this part of our discussion before we move on. Just got to ask you, Terry, are there any points that you think the Republicans will agree to sort of close the gap on this issue of, you know, just, you know, should they have badges? Should there be something? I mean,
And Holman said over the weekend, he said, look, this really is for Congress to figure out because the authority lies within Congress to determine the law. Like the administrative warrant question is a big question. And I think Congress has to fix that because all of the Obama policies were done with administrative warrants as well. I do think there'll be movement on masks. I do think there'll be movement on some IDs, some identification issues. But it's not going to be. It's all this or it's all that.
Yeah. All right, let's move on. We're going to talk about the SAVE Act and election security now. The House passed the SAVE America Act requiring in-person proof of citizenship and photo ID for federal elections. It's now before the Senate. I want to start with you, Solomon, get your thoughts on the SAVE Act. I mean, I know Pennsylvania had a voter ID back in the day. We got it overturned, and now we're talking voter ID again. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that voter ID is a way to decrease the number of people who are voting. I work with young men every day who, you know, many of them don't have identification or have expired identification or have photocopies of their identification. These are young men who are at the very bottom of the socioeconomic ladder. And I think that if you require voter ID, certainly, you know, people should vote legally. People should be identified. But requiring voter ID is not about identifying those who are voting. It is about reducing the pool so that Republicans have a better chance to win. It's been a long-term strategy of theirs. This is not something that's new. They're doing it to try to reduce the voter pool because that's the way they win.
And I'd love to get your thoughts, Terry, because there's been a lot of polls show that there's wide support for voter ID.
In my view, this is another issue where the Democrats can't get out of their own way. I mean, they do a masterful job at snatching you know, defeat from the jaws of victory. They're well positioned to do well in the midterms. And this is an issue where they're just hurting themselves. They don't need to draw lines with everything just because it's, you know, we hate Republicans, we hate Trump. This is an area where I think both parties, I think Republicans could stop with there are millions of illegals voting. There's no data to support that. But there's also no data to support that voter ID depresses minority participation or turnout. You look at what happened in Georgia, for example. Remember, the All-Star game was pulled from Georgia because of the voting restrictions that were put in place that people were upset about. What happened? Well, all voter participation went up, minority voter participation went up. And I would argue that maybe there's something to be said for the fact that when people have basic trust in the system, they want to participate more because they believe in it. And the reality is, and there's lots of fault to go around, people have a profound mistrust of the system, and this is a very, very basic, very simple way to restore that.
What do you think is reasonable? Because I think one of the pushback, right, is that if you require – the passport costs money, so that could be one form of identification, and you know that might be difficult for people to obtain. There's some issue with the birth certificate stuff because people change their names over the course of their lives. Many people do.
Yeah, women especially. Yeah.
So do you think those are like the proper forms of identification, or do you think there could be a compromise, Terry, where there's a higher form than what's required now? It's a national standard, but it's not doesn't go to the level of birth certificate or, you know, passport.
You know, my concern on that would be a bit of a constitutional one, in the sense that there was a movement in the early 2000s for sort of a national ID, right? And conservatives reflexively were sort of anti that.
Mitch McConnell still is.
Yeah, they don't. Mm-hmm. The idea of having a national ID, and there are plenty of other mechanisms for producing. I don't know who these people are, right? That don't have the capacity to get some kind of identification when they need it to, like, buy a beer, or they need it to buy cigarettes, or they need it to do, like, get on an airplane. I mean, the basic things in life. And certainly I think what the SAVE Act does well, mm-hmm, is provide for the necessary pathways to subsidies or what have you for anybody that does have that barrier to entry, mm-hmm, to have it otherwise reduced and work with the states to get there.
Yeah, Salome, can you respond to Terry's point about how maybe, mm-hmm, these fears are overblown? We did see some changes to requirements in Georgia. There was a lot of pushback. And then ultimately, the turnout in Georgia looked similar to prior turnouts, in fact, maybe higher. So do you think that Democrats are overstating the potential problem here?
So I Googled it just quickly. Mm-hmm. And what I found, minority, low-income, elderly Americans significantly less likely to possess current government-issued photo ID compared to their white counterparts. Studies show that 25% of black adults and 15-16% of Hispanic adults lack such ID. And so this is targeting those people. If you can cut the amount of people from those communities who vote, then you cut the amount of people who are likely to vote for Democrats. Nothing wrong with having ID. Give those IDs for free. Mm-hmm. You talk about getting on an airplane as one of the basics of life. People in the hood aren't getting on planes. Yeah. You know, people who don't have money aren't getting on planes. They can go into a what they're now calling beer delis. We call them stop and goes. They can get in there. They don't need ID. They'll give you a beer, right? And so this whole notion that people they should have ID anyway. Yes, that's true. But the reality is that there are a 25% of black adults who don't, 15 to 16% of Hispanics who don't. If you want people to have ID in order to vote, give it to them for free.
And I want to ask you this, Terry, because during the voter ID, I covered that extensively. Yeah. There were a lot of people who were older, who had been voting for decades, and they were not going to be able to vote. And these are people who were citizens, I mean, born in the South, certain things existed. Your thoughts on that and whether or not there would be some fail safes to ensure that people who legacy have been able to vote would not be kept from the polls.
If we don't have a government that has the capacity to implement universal ID, then why are we having conversations about universal health care? This is really not a difficult problem to solve. If folks are willing to come out and vote, they're willing to come out and get, that means they want to participate in society. That means they have a certain sense of civic responsibility and civic pride. It means they're sufficiently engaged in their communities. All of that tells me that they certainly have the capacity to get an ID if, to Solomon's point, the barriers to entry like cost and what have you are otherwise addressed. There's no reason why folks should not have identification at this in 2026. There's no reason why cost should be a barrier to entry. The ability to deliver this like at scale, inexpensively, is really not a big ask. This is an area where I think Republicans and Democrats would be smart to come together and get a win, a compromise and a win.
Real quick, are you concerned though, as a conservative, about federal election standards or the federalization of election practices?
No, I mean, this specific issue, am I concerned about that generally? Sure.
Yeah.
This specific issue, I believe it's Article 4, Section 1, allows Congress to make changes to these kinds of laws from time to time, is the exact language. And so you're not taking away the state's responsibility for administering the elections.
Right.
That would be a problem. But providing guidelines that say states, of which 19 or 20 of them already have ID requirements, need to have IDs, and the government is going to subsidize the implementation of the ID requirement, is certainly within the bounds of federalism.
Yeah. Unless the federal government is prepared to pay for these IDs for people who don't have money, it amounts to a poll tax. Mm-hmm. Unless they are willing to pay for these IDs, pay the states to give people IDs, then it's an unfunded mandate for the states.
And that's in the act.
And so what they need to do is make it free, mm-hmm, just like they should make health care free, so that everybody has access to it. And then it's not a barrier. Yeah. Then it's not a poll tax. It's not an unfunded mandate.
And we're going to move on, but we'll be seeing if the Senate will vote for this. So far, they don't have the votes, but, you know, the Senate Majority Leader has said this will come up for a vote. By the way, Better Integra on YouTube says, how could a winning strategy be, quote, less voters? You make no sense. That's what Better Integra on YouTube had to say. I want to move on to the Epstein files because more than 3 million Epstein-related documents have been released. Lawmakers accused the DOJ of excessive redaction. Some survivors' identities have been exposed. You saw Pam Bondi, our attorney general, not answering questions before lawmakers. Just your thoughts on how this sort of the impact of her testimony or non-testimony and just this whole the fallout aftermath of the Epstein files and its impact on the Trump administration, Terry.
I think it's a distraction. I really do. I'm not saying it's not an important issue. Clearly, the depravity and, you know, the things that are revealed about American elites, like there are lots of cultural and social questions to be asked of this. But in terms of when you look at what's going on globally, when you look at the issues we're debating domestically, for this to continue to percolate as being something that is of great national import, to me, it just doesn't rise to that level. It deserves, folks deserve to be held accountable. Mm-hmm. The scrutiny is required, et cetera, et cetera. But I mean, I don't know. The Secretary of State just gave like the most important speech by an American on the continent of Europe since 1987. Mm-hmm. To me, that's and there's major questions about that's where our focus should be. This is something that's become sort of a sideshow, if you ask me.
The president ran on this. Your thoughts?
Yeah. In terms of the Epstein files, Republicans wanted it until they found out that all the people in the Epstein files, a lot of them were Republicans. A lot of them were the people who they believe should be the elite, should be the leaders, should be the people running the country. They thought it was going to be Democrats in some pizza shop running a child porn ring. No, it's the people that you know. It's a secretary on the cabinet. It's the president of the United States in there at least 38,000 times. One of the congressmen who saw the files and reviewed them said it might be a million times. And so the question is, why are other people facing consequences for being in the Epstein files, but the guy who's in it the most, he's still sitting in the White House. I'm trying to figure that out. And so they wanted it until they figured out, wow, our guy's in there more than anybody else. Let's move on.
Do you think
let's not.
Do you think it matters to voters and will matter to voters moving forward, Solomon?
I think that it's going to matter in the midterm elections because of the way it's being handled, right? I think that Pam Bondi being asked about the Epstein files and talking about the Dow is completely out of touch. Like, what do you mean? It's just, it's bizarre to watch the way that this administration is responding to mm-hmm. it, to see them putting out documents that are completely redacted, thousands of pages of black pages. What is that? You know, if you're going to put it out every day that they don't, they're breaking the law. The deadline is long past.
And Sarah, do you agree with that? I'm curious how you think. No, but just talking about the politics of this now, we're not mm-hmm. talking about the criminal investigations. I think one theory is that the Epstein files more generally undercut one of President Trump's great political messages, which is that I'm a champion for the people against the elites, and that the people in my cabinet feel the same way. Do you think politically that's consequential, that ultimately we'll look back and say this was something we were talking about for a few weeks, a few years ago, and, you know, things move on?
I think it's more the latter, but it doesn't mean that the problems are not significant. The Epstein operation was not a partisan operation. Both parties have high-profile names on
sure.
there.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, part of my when this started to emerge as a major national issue earlier this year, like I said to myself, there's gonna be some significant collateral damage here because there are definitely people who were just passersby
sure.
that are going to get released and they're going to be associated. And where is the due process? I think that's sort of grossly unfair. But I think in terms of just the rank punditry, the purely political terms, I don't think this moves the needle outside of certain subsets of the electorate that already believe, and probably to some extent we already know, that the institutions and individuals that run many elite American institutions are corrupted.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it validates that, but I don't know that that political
it confirms for people that already believe.
That's correct.
And by the way, we're going to push the break about a minute because I want to just ask you before we go to our break about Trump's approval ratings and impact on the midterms. We got a lot coming up. He's talking the Epstein files fallout. You got all this fight over nationalizing elections, and then you got, you know, the economy not doing great, people feeling some kind of way. and his approval rating under 40%. Your thoughts on how this will shake out in the midterms as we go to get ready for a break?
Well, Trump is at this point in his term, he's about 4 points lower in the polls than Biden was. And Biden was not a popular president.
Not killing it.
No, right? No, and no, so no. Trump is doing even worse. I think that they depend on people caring about Venezuelan oil and caring about what's happening in Ukraine and caring about what's happening in Gaza and caring about this peace board that he's putting together and all of this stuff. We care about how much our groceries are when we go to the market. Our groceries cost more when we go to the market. It's about the tariffs that Trump has put in place that have raised the prices.
Yeah.
And that's what people are going to be voting on. That's what people care about.
And so, Terry, I mean, the big focus has been international foreign policy, but bread and butter issues seem to have not been top of mind for the president. Your thoughts?
Let's talk bread and butter. Inflation is down. The labor market is strong. Wages go further, significantly further than they did already than under the Biden administration. There's been a 6-point swing on that front. The economy grew 3.8 percentage points in Q2, 4.4 in Q3, projected to be 3.7 in Q4. And there was a CNN poll out just over the weekend that showed that 58% of Americans believe the Democratic Party has gone way too far to the left. So in terms of...
But doesn't it sound like the same thing that Joe Biden did during his presidency, sort of saying these statistics but not feeling what the American people were feeling?
These statistics are substantially better, and the guy's been in office for a year.
But does it address the feeling that America?
I mean, it was a big hole that we had to dig out of that the Biden administration left this administration. And to see these kinds of results this quickly, we've talked about tariffs on this show before. There was not going to be a scenario in which tariff policy was going to provide GDP growth at any point in the first year. It's just not possible to have that kind of impact. So, but you're starting to see the ship turn around, and I do believe the Trump administration will be rewarded for it at the polls in the midterms.
I don't think people care about the numbers. People didn't care about the numbers under Biden, and guess what? They don't care about the numbers now. They know
why not?
That when they...
But I think this is something that I think crosses the political aisle, this idea that you can see some relatively good economic data, and I think you could argue, a lot of Biden people have argued, that there was some good economic data under Biden as well.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't translate to voter sentiment at all. Like,
because
what is happening here?
People vote based on what they feel and what they see in their real everyday lives. Groceries are more. Prices are up as far as people are concerned. The numbers don't mean that.
The huge tax refunds, they're going to feel that, and they're coming.
All right. Well, we'll talk more. I think we're going to do some local issues on the other side of this break. We'll read some comments. We'd love to hear from you. Studio 2 at WHYY.org, 888-477-9499.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. This hour, we're talking about the week's most important news stories. Earlier, we looked at the leading national news, and now we want to bring it home and focus on local and state stories, including the pushback against ICE cooperation in Philadelphia City Council, Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro's state budget, the governor's race, and the race for Pennsylvania's 3rd Congressional District.
Still with us are Terry Tracy, founder of Broad and Liberty and CEO of Fidere News Network, as well as Solomon Jones, Philadelphia Inquirer columnist and WURD radio host. If you're out there listening, we'd love to hear from you. What news are you paying most attention to? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. YouTube, Facebook, drop a comment in the chat. Michael from Bucks County says the Democrats had the political capital to create an easier path to green card and citizenship, and now they're complaining they have deaths on their hands. Mike from Germantown says, as a longtime poll worker, this whole ID thing is nonsense. We know our neighbors. It's ridiculous to think they're strangers. This distraction is being done on purpose.
Yeah, so we're going to jump into our local politics. The big race right now is the Pennsylvania race for governor. You have Stacey Garrity, the Republican, running against incumbent Josh Shapiro. Your thoughts? I mean, Josh Shapiro has a pretty decent war chest at this point. You know, Solomon, I mean, he has the momentum.
Josh Shapiro is going to win. I mean, he's a veteran politician, came up as a Montgomery County commissioner. I've watched him over the years. He's only gotten better in terms of being able to grasp where people are, where the voters are, what the voters want. And he's got a national profile. I think that that Josh Shapiro is well positioned not only to win the governorship. I asked him the other day when I interviewed him, you know, what are you going to do in 2028? He's like, well, we're going to focus on the midterms. We want to focus on what's going on here. But I think we need to watch him also on the national stage.
Yeah, Terry. I mean, Garrity, do you think does she have a shot?
Well, the national stage is the only place you're going to find Josh Shapiro.
Yeah.
Because the voters that he's interested in are in New Hampshire and Iowa and South Carolina, not in Pennsylvania. Stacey Garrity is a very strong candidate. She should not be underestimated. When she took on her first race for treasurer against an incumbent Democrat who was well-known and popular from Montgomery County, Joe Torsella, nobody gave the woman a chance. The woman is... she's smart as a whip. She is patient. She's authentic. And she's done a great job as treasurer. She's been successful in business. She's a combat veteran in Iraq. She's got a really compelling story to tell. And I look at the media coverage of the new governor of New Jersey and sort of the way that she was presented to the public. And I'm waiting for the media in Pennsylvania to provide a similar coverage of Stacey Garrity, because I think there's a lot of parallels there.
Yeah. We should say, by the way, that these two are the presumptive nominees. They actually technically won their primaries yet, but the decks have been cleared more or less. Mm-hmm. Shapiro on the Democratic side, Garrity on the Republican side. And Terry, one of the, I think, internal theories within the PA GOP, which is if you give Garrity a nice, easy path to the general, it's going to help her, and that she's the better candidate than Doug Mastriano because she's got broader appeal.
Yeah.
Do you think that she's been able to make that case to donors? Because let's be honest, that's kind of where you need to be making the case right now when you're not really running for an election until November.
Stacey's kind of the little engine that could. And yeah. She doesn't have Shapiro's war chest. She's not going to have Shapiro's war chest. It's just not going to happen. But she doesn't need to.
And she also doesn't quite have, I guess, the Mastriano grassroots network and appeal.
No, she does.
You think she does?
Actually, that is, in terms of the PAGOP dynamics, that's one of her biggest strengths, is that a committee that otherwise would probably be very divided and there'd be a lot of contention about sort of grassroots versus establishment, what have none of that's there this time.
Mm-hmm.
And the party made a huge mistake in 2022 by not endorsing. It still would have been an uphill battle, certainly, but having 16 candidates run, winnowed down to 4 or 5, this guy's endorsed, that guy's not endorsed, no one's endorsed, what you wound up was getting a candidate that was especially weak for that particular election cycle. Shapiro's not going to have that pass this time. He's never really had a difficult challenge. He's never really been on a debate stage with somebody who can call him on his fairly significant failings as governor. And he's going to have a much tougher race this time than I think folks are expecting. And the thing about Shapiro that strikes me is when you do push his buttons, he doesn't respond well. So it's going to be interesting to see the way the Garrity campaign handles that.
Yeah, a lot of people feel Shapiro's kind of had a gilded path through his various offices, just the way things have broken. And we've certainly point to the matchup with Mastriano last time in 2022 is just instance of good luck and maybe not instance of great political skill.
Well, Mastriano was a guy in a Confederate uniform. I mean, let's be clear. He was a right wing zealot, and that's the reason he lost. He was so far to the right that people were like, no, we don't think so.
But do you think Josh Shapiro could be tested, but just by a stronger candidate?
I think he could be tested by a stronger candidate, but again, he's got the history, he's got the experience. He came up from a Montgomery County commissioner, and that means something. You know, he ran for attorney general, stayed there for a couple of terms, became the governor of the state of Pennsylvania, and I would disagree with the assertion that the only place you would find him is on the national stage. Again, I just interviewed him a couple days ago on WURD. And so, you know, he's here, he's local, and he's known.
One of the national issues Shapiro has been very vocal about is sort of ICE and some of the dealings that we've been seeing in ICE. And we've been getting a lot of local pushback, particularly here in Philadelphia. You recently, Council President Kenyatta Johnson has said that, you know, Philadelphia cannot afford to be silent.
Yeah.
Yet the Parker administration has, you know, said that Philadelphia is not a sanctuary city, or didn't say those words. The words that they use here is that Philadelphia is a welcoming city.
Right.
Your thoughts on the ICE pushback that the city has had? Should they be more vocal, like the council president has said?
Mm-hmm.
You know, just just how local municipalities have been doing and pushing back against.
Well, I think it's been interesting the way that Philadelphia has responded. It reminds me of a protest movement, right, where you have some people working on the inside in the offices and they're working quietly, bureaucratically. And then you have some people outside in the street, raising Cain. And so I think that Philadelphia has kind of an inside outside strategy. You've got Larry Krasner saying everything under the sun about ICE because Larry Krasner is safe. People love Larry Krasner. You have Rochelle Bilal saying, you know, we're going to lock you up. You've got the park administration kind of being quiet and waiting and seeing how this thing is going to play out, because there's going to have to be cooperation with the federal government during this 250th anniversary when the whole world is here in Philadelphia. It does not pay the Merrill administration to have a contentious relationship with the Trump administration when Philadelphia is getting ready to be the center of the universe during this year.
Yeah, your thoughts, Terry, on how the city has sort of been quietly, I guess, pushing back to the Trump administration, but not as vocal as like a Krasner, like, you know, the council president says it needs to be.
I don't know if Mayor Parker wants me to answer that question because it probably doesn't help her out that much, but she should be commended for her restraint. She's handled this. Her administration has handled this issue particularly deftly. You know, my view of city politics is city council tends to take every goofy left-wing idea that can't actually be implemented and try to be the first to pass it. And in this instance, they have not tried to out-left the left. They have certainly shared their concerns and their criticisms, but they've been measured for the most part. And I think Solomon's point is a good one. I mean, we are going to be on the world stage for much of 2026. Like it or not, the federal government is going to be a significant partner in that process. Also, this is not just about the government, too. There are a number of community philanthropic organizations that are involved in the planning. And I think everybody's just trying to play nicely in the sandbox together. And it's the prudent thing to do. If you want to make it a circus, you know, do the Jacob Fry thing in Minneapolis. And then, you know, let's see what good that does for the city.
Yeah, we're hearing from you this hour about what's really on your mind. Mark from Green Lane is worried about healthcare. Talks about the fact that the number of people who have health insurance through the state exchange here in Pennsylvania is down significantly. Deborah from Havertown says, thank you to Solomon for his honesty about the current administration. Normal people out here are concerned about everyday costs. I don't care what party you're in. Both are currently catering to the elites, and I'm sick of it. Lynn says, a poll watcher and veteran says that this show missed a major point. You cannot register to vote without proving citizenship. So really, this ID business is a total joke. And Reggie from Phillipsburg is really concerned about ICE as it pertains to worker shortages. He says that if ICE deports millions of people, we're going to have a real issue with labor. We're getting toward the end of the hour here. Wanted to throw out one more political race we haven't talked about yet, which is the race for the 3rd Congressional District. Mm-hmm. This is the seat currently held by Dwight Evans. He's retiring. Yeah. And it's expected to be a safe Democratic seat, but it's a really crowded Democratic primary.
Yeah.
Sharif Street, who's a state senator here and is the son of John Street, is the money leader in that race right now, Solomon. How do you see PA3 shaping up?
I think it's interesting. I moderated a forum in West Philadelphia with several of the candidates in that race, Sharif Street, Dr. Ayla Stanford, as well as Representative Morgan Cephas. And so you have a veteran politician in Sharif Street who is well positioned to win. I think that you have some other candidates who have some great stories. Dr. Ayla Stanford is one of them. I think you have Representative Morgan Cephas, who has a base in West Philly. You have Chris Rabb, who didn't show up for that forum, who has a base in the Northwest. I think people have to get their bases to come out in order to compete with Sharif Street. I think he's going to have the backing of the bigwigs in the party.
You see him as the favorite.
I do see him as the favorite, but I think that if people can get their bases to come out and if they can raise enough money to compete with them, it could be a competitive race, but I do see him as the favorite.
Yeah. Dr. David Oxman also in that race. Many others. I mean, look, I think these types of split fields are the hardest to predict, but you went out on a limb. Thank you for that, Solomon.
Yeah.
Terry, look, we're getting to the end of this hour. Anything that we haven't talked about that you think's, you know, been on your mind locally, statewide, nationally?
Yeah, I'm Politics PA, which is part of our network, hosted a forum for PA3 last week in Rittenhouse Square. A very similar assessment as Solomon's. It looks like it's Senator Street's race to lose, but some interesting candidates in that mix. But I think either way, the people of the third are positioned to be well served. I will say one story that I think deserves more attention is going on in Delaware County. I've raised this issue on the show before. Taxes in that county have gone up 55% in the last 3 years. And the gentleman who the Democrats nominated to be chair of that commission, it's found out, owes the government about $300,000 in back taxes. Mm-hmm. And there's been some calls for him to resign or step down from the chairmanship role, because that is the enforcement agency, and he's refused to do so. And I think there should be more scrutiny from the press on this particular story, because the hypocrisy is pretty substantial.
Yeah. Big story. Any story that we didn't cover that you think needs more light?
The president's house.
Yeah.
The president's house at 6th and Market, about a block from here. Mm-hmm. That, of course, is a huge story. And not just because the Trump administration took crowbars to history and tried to pry it off the walls. But I think it's because of this notion that you can change reality for people, that you can change history, that you can change what has already happened in order to control what they think about their present and about their future. It's not going to stop here. It's something that has to be fought. That story is critically important, not just in Philadelphia, but nationally.
Yeah, and I'll mention that today the city council was having hearings today of the school's closures as well.
Yeah.
That is happening today, and the school board will have to, you know, talk about that on the 26th of the month. So that's another big story as well.
Let me thank our guests, Solomon Jones, Philadelphia Inquirer columnist, WURD host. Thanks for your time, as always, Solomon.
Thank you.
And same to you, Terry Tracy, founder of Broad and Liberty and CEO of Fidere News Network. Terry, always a pleasure to have you here
on
Studio.
Thank you, guys. Thanks, Solomon.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Yep. And thank you to everybody who wrote in today. I always enjoy having you two gentlemen on the show. It's always a robust conversation. By the way, thank you so much to our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel May Bryan. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. We appreciate him. And Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk with you tomorrow.